Bay, New Mexico. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see our shows and podcast, video, or audio, you can go to democracynow.org. You can also get our daily digest. Just go to democracynow.org to sign up. Also, to see the various topics we cover throughout the years, our 27 years, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County Animal Shelter suffered from negligence and understaffing. Now they announced the first part of their review. 500,000 Multnomah County ballots will need to be reprinted before the May election, and President Biden will run for re-election in 2024. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 25th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. The Multnomah County Board of Commissioners received their first briefing on the review of the troubled Multnomah County Animal Shelter today. Michelle Coppola has this report.
The Multnomah County Board of Commissioners was briefed today on the findings of Phase 1 in the ongoing review of the Multnomah County Animal Shelter, known as MCAS. In January, Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Pedersen launched a full review of animal services after the shelter was forced to temporarily close due to a lack of staff and overcrowding. This led to multiple news reports in local media over the past few months that revealed a years-long pattern of mismanagement, substandard and even negligent animal care, overcrowding, and serious staff issues. Lee Gerard, interim manager of community services, and Aaron Grayheck, the newest director of MCAS, presented the report to the Board of Commissioners. Among the conclusions in the report were the fact that most of the recommendations and audits from 2016 and 2018 were never completed, and in some cases, services and operations at the shelter actually declined. MCAS Director Aaron Grayheck had this to say about the findings.
The findings in Phase 1A are sobering and include a tally of recommendations from the 2016 audit, the 2018 audit follow-up, the Dogs Playing for Life consultation. It's important to note that many of the recommendations marked as partially complete or incomplete have seen progress towards implementation or may be in process, but with an alternative approach. Significant areas remain to be addressed, including staffing and volunteer levels to meet national cleaning, feeding, and enrichment recommendations. This is an area corroborated by all sources reviewed. A key focus of this work has been to identify what is needed and hone in on how to move forward from here.
That was Aaron Grayheck, current director of MCAS. The report from Phase 1 of the MCAS review also shows that gaps persist in staffing, equipment, protocols, documentation, training, and procedures. After the report, the Board of Commissioners questioned Gerard and Grayheck about the process for accountability moving forward and requested more frequent updates. Commissioner Sharon Myron also expressed her frustration that these longstanding issues at the shelter have not been addressed with more urgency.
There are some exceptional community advocates, members of our community, and organizations who have been reaching out and trying to scream at us to say these things have been happening for years. And there have been issues that I've been raising for at least a year when the gravity of these issues came to my attention through, again, some incredible community-based organizations and partners. And come January, I hear back from Pixie Project, I hear back from some community partners, Nothing seems to have been done. And I have been just devastated and trying to figure out. We use the words urgency and we use the words real time, and we're going to make progress improvements. But what does that mean? This happened in January, and it does not seem like urgency.
That was Commissioner Sharon Meyer. And later in the briefing, Commissioner Lori Stegman had this to say about the findings.
I think how I would describe the state of animal service right now is disturbing. And it is very disturbing to this board, to myself, and I know to each of you, and for everyone who loves our animals in the community.
Commissioner Lori Stegman there with her reaction to the briefing on phase one of the MCAS review. Next steps in the shelter review include phase two of the audit, which Director Grahek says will focus on community feedback and involvement. Public comment on these issues will be taken at the next regular meeting of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners this Thursday, April 27. For KBOO News, I'm Michelle Coppola.
Multnomah County Elections made a costly error when printing ballots for the May election. The county planned to send out over 500,000 ballots on Wednesday, but mistakenly put the ballot for the District 3 County Commissioner race on all those ballots. Only a portion of the county's voters are eligible to vote on that seat. Now, the county must reprint more than 500,000 ballots, likely costing the county more than $300,000. Tim Scott is Multnomah County's elections director, and he said it was a proofing error that led to the mistake. Some 5,000 Multnomah County voters already got their ballots that were printed wrong. The county says only people who are eligible to vote in the District 3 commissioner race will have votes counted towards that race. District 3 extends from around 33rd to 148th Avenue south of I-84. Those voters will be selecting a candidate to fill out the rest of Commissioner Jessica Vega Peterson's term after she was elected to county chair. President Joe Biden formally announced today that he is running for re-election in 2024. He asked voters to give him more time to, quote, finish the job he began this round and to set aside their concerns about his age. Biden would be 86 years old at the end of a second term. Experts believe he faces a smooth path, no serious Democratic rivals, easily winning his party's nomination, but beating the Republican candidate will not be so easy. His announcement came on the four-year anniversary of his declaring for the White House in 2019, during the turbulent presidency of Donald Trump. The president is set to run on the same themes that propelled his party to unexpected victories in last fall's midterm elections, particularly preserving access to abortion. He also plans to campaign on his record. He spent his first 2 years as president dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, and he pushed through major bills like the bipartisan infrastructure package plus legislation to promote high-tech manufacturing and climate measures. The president still has multiple goals and unmet promises from his first campaign, like passing a ban on assault-style weapons, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, and codifying a national right to abortion. He still faces criticism over the haphazard 2021 withdrawal from Afghanistan. He's been repeatedly criticized by Republicans over his immigration and economic policies. Biden will likely continue to suggest that all Republicans are embracing so-called ultra-mega politics, a reference to Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, regardless of whether or not Trump ends up on the 2024 ballot. Many Democrats would prefer that Biden didn't run again. A recent poll demonstrated that just 47% of Democrats say they want him to seek a second term. That is up from 37% in February. While some in his party prefer an alternative to Biden, there's no consensus on who that might be. To win in 2024, Biden will need significant support from young and Black voters, women, moderates, and perhaps disaffected Republicans who helped him win in 2020. He will have to preserve his position in Georgia and Arizona, longtime Republican strongholds he narrowly won last time. Being the incumbent is no guarantee of re-election. Three of the last seven presidents lost on their second try, most recently Trump in 2020. Biden announced, quote, "I said we are in a battle for the soul of America, and we still are. The question we are facing is whether in the years ahead we have more freedom or less freedom, more rights or fewer," end quote. Billionaire Nike co-founder Phil Knight will donate $400 million to a new investment fund meant to support Black Portland residents. The gift goes towards the 1803 Fund, helping to fund education services, art programs, and other projects in North and Northeast Portland. The fund aims to repair some of what the historic black neighborhood, Albina, lost in decades of racial redlining, gentrification, and racially targeted construction projects. It's not clear yet how the funds will be distributed. The 1803 Fund is led by Rukaya Adams, a founding board member of the Albina Vision Trust. That group is perhaps best known for its efforts in advocating for Black Portlanders in the I-5 Rose Quarter expansion project. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments on mifepristone soon. Illinois legislation could restore voting rights for all, and the Ohio River is endangered. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think everybody's very concerned about what happens with medication abortion, but this case is about, can the FDA make science-based decisions and have those stand without interference?
Mara Gandel Powers with the National Women's Law Center is worried about what the recent legal battle over the abortion pill mifepristone could mean for other FDA-approved drugs. Critics have tried to ban mifepristone despite its FDA approval 23 years ago. The U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas judge's decision to suspend the drug's use, but the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments next month. But Gandel Powers is confident this fight will end up back at the Supreme Court, which overturned Roe v. Wade. For the time being, Maine's medical community is overjoyed by the High Court's decision to preserve access to the drug. Maine Governor Janet Mills is considering stockpiling it just in case. Eric Steele, president of the Maine Medical Association, says most physicians think the decision to end a pregnancy needs to be made in a doctor's office, not in a courtroom.
If they simply outlaw the medication, women will find another way around it to make their own decisions about their pregnancies.
Several groups in Illinois are advocating for legislation that would restore voting rights, including for people who are incarcerated. Illinois could be the first state to approve such a law. A poll from Stand Up America shows about 60% of Illinois voters support this effort, guaranteeing the right to vote for all citizens age 18 and older. Katrina Fid, with Chicago Votes, supports voting rights restoration because she says democracy works better when more people are involved. She notes the dehumanization of the prison population complicates issues like this, adding, people aren't really aware of who is in Illinois state prisons.
We also know that this is a racial issue, too. I mean, 55% of people in Illinois prisons are Black, even though Black people make up less than 15% of the overall state population. Disenfranchisement and that silencing, it has long-term consequences.
A recent report finds the Ohio River is the second most endangered in the nation, the first being the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. The report by the group American Rivers finds the Ohio River is falling victim to discharges of mercury, dioxins, and forever chemicals also known as PFAS, along with pollutants from manufacturing as threats to human and environmental health. Heather Sprouse with the West Virginia Rivers Coalition says the February derailment of a Norfolk Southern train in East Palestine, Ohio, placed the spotlight on the need for long-term river monitoring and on improving the health of the Ohio River.
While there's a number of waters that receive significant and sustained federal funding, right now the Ohio River doesn't receive any, and so the goal is to change that.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Big Picture Science Radio, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a few clouds and an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather kicks off a warm few days in Portland with a daytime high of 73. Today in history, in 2014, the Flint water crisis begins. That's when officials in Flint, Michigan switched the city's water supply to the Flint River, leading to lead and bacteria contamination. The quote of the day is from American jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald, who was born today in 1917. She said, quote, "It isn't where you came from, it's where you're going that counts." Navajo President Boone Grin says the full force of the Navajo Nation is behind assisting flood victims in Chinle, Arizona. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Navajo leaders say they're deploying all necessary resources to assist residents being impacted by flooding in Chinle, Arizona. Flooding began Friday when a berm from a wash running through the community failed to hold back rising water. Resources have been deployed from across the Navajo Nation to help. The Office of the President is providing flooding updates on social media. Navajo Nation President Boone Igren says the full force of the Navajo Nation has been made available to assist the community. The Vice President of the tribe, Rochelle Montoya, has been on site and has met with families being impacted. Assistance has also come from the county, the American Red Cross, and local residents. Reconstruction of the berm is underway. The Navajo Nation declared a state of emergency in January for the ongoing need of resources, which is helping address the Chinle flooding. The American Red Cross has opened a shelter to help people in the area. Tribal colleges in Minnesota hope the state legislature will help with funding needs. Tribal college leaders say the schools teach students and help maintain Native language and culture. Mike Moen has more.
Tribal colleges not only teach students, they're also institutions that maintain Native American languages and cultural history. In Minnesota, these schools hope the legislature gives them a funding boost. A bill this session would set aside $3 million in each year of the next biennium. The state's three tribal colleges could apply for grants for general operation and maintenance expenses. Leech Lake Tribal College President Helen Montgomery says it would be transformative for her school. She says they could use funds to add more learning space and get up-to-date resources for STEM courses.
Certainly a lot of the learning that we do is outside, and we do have programs that teach an Indigenous perspective on not just science, but the environment. It would be really great to have some modern equipment.
She says the funds could also help remove student aid barriers and provide staff a cost-of-living wage increase she describes as long overdue. Tribal colleges get most of their funding from the federal government, and leaders say it covers only the bare minimum. Montgomery says helping schools like hers allows them to keep offering a culturally inclusive environment where Native students can ease into the college setting. She says these individuals don't have to feel isolated as they navigate their higher education path.
We would be able to hire personnel or create experiences that help our students bridge the tribal college setting to the four-year setting.
According to the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute, 41% of first-time, full-time Native American students attending four-year colleges graduate within 6 years, compared to 63% for all students.
That was Mike Moen reporting. A new round of grant funding for projects in Michigan that highlight tribes and Native Americans in the state is now open by the Native American Heritage Fund. K-12 schools, higher education institutions, and local governments may be eligible for funding. Board Chair Jamie Stuck says while other states like New York are banning the use of Native American mascots, the Heritage Fund is proud to provide the opportunity and funding to make culturally appropriate changes in the state. The grants are intended to promote positive relationships and accurate information about the history and role of Michigan's tribes and Native Americans. Projects could include things like events and art or help remove mascots and imagery. The Heritage Fund was created in 2016 through the Tribal State Gaming Compact, which allocates the funds. Since then, funding has helped with the removal of imagery from 12 schools and 2 municipalities with more than $2 million in distributions. Applications will be accepted through mid-June. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Fentanyl in the U.S. may now be laced with an animal tranquilizer called xylazine in what drug officials are calling the third wave of the opioid epidemic. Nadia Ramlagan has more in Kentucky.
According to the Drug Enforcement Administration, in the Commonwealth, xylazine has so far shown up at DEA labs in the Florence-Covington area and in Louisville. DEA Detroit Division Special Agent in Charge, Orville Green, explains xylazine, also known as Trank, is a powerful sedative and muscle relaxant that slows down the respiratory system and can cause severe gaping wounds. He says xylazine is worsening the drug crisis because it is not reversible by naloxone, and because of the gruesome gruesome effects it has on users.
One of the additional challenges is that people who inject drug mixtures containing xylazine can also develop severe wounds, including necrosis, and some cases have led to amputations.
Xylazine has now been detected in street drugs in 48 states. Earlier this month, the Office of National Drug Control Policy officially designated fentanyl mixed with xylazine as an emerging threat to the United States. Orville points out xylazine is currently not a federally controlled substance, meaning it's easier to obtain and difficult to track.
It allows the traffickers to reduce the amount of fentanyl or heroin, for example, in the mixture, and ultimately just increases the profits. It's very cheap to obtain.
A U.S. Department of Justice and DEA report found the prevalence of xylazine in the illicit drug supply jumped by more than 193% in the South over the past 2 years. Xylazine-positive fatal overdoses have increased by more than 100% in the region. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
A study out of the University of Texas found that a simple phone call to those experiencing depression can help curb symptoms in homebound older adults. The conversation can be nothing more than catching up on the weather, known as sunshine calls. The study included a 4-week randomized control trial of 240 mostly homebound older adults. Roz Brown has more.
Many Americans experience depression or anxiety, but a new Texas study shows a regular phone call to those suffering can reduce symptoms. Known as sunshine calls, the study recruited 240 mostly homebound older adults suffering from depressive symptoms. University of Texas at Austin study author Minnie Kalin says the phone calls were made by people who were not healthcare professionals, but had undergone a brief training about how to listen and ask questions. She believes the study adds to a growing area of research focused on alternate models for delivering mental health support.
The calls never preach, right? They are always about the topics that are of interest to the participant. Now, will it help everyone? Probably not. But will it help a whole bunch of people? Potentially, yes.
The study used a standardized measurement scale and noted that depressive symptoms of those who participated dropped from an average of 13 down to 9. Kalin says a score of 10 and above signifies symptoms of clinical depression. She says the study started with participants receiving 5 calls a week to establish a relationship with the caller.
And then at the end of the week, we asked them, well, do you want a call a day or do you want fewer calls? And so about 50% stuck with a call a day, but 50% shifted down to 2 or 3 calls a week.
Many people lead increasingly isolated lives. At the same time, Kalin says there's also a shortage of mental health professionals, and what's available is often too expensive for those on a fixed income. She believes sunshine calls are a low-cost, minimally invasive solution.
There's no other agenda other than to really hear from them about what's important to them on their terms, which is why, by the way, they continue to pick up the phone, which is quite a rare thing these days.
The program was developed by Health Factor, an initiative of Del Med and the Episcopal Health Foundation in collaboration with Meals on Wheels, Central Texas. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
China is Russia's most important partner, but that comes with some caveats. Now we go to a Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In the war in Ukraine, the China-Russia relationship is a wild card. The notion persists going back to the Putin-Xi meeting in Beijing just before Putin launched his war on Ukraine, that there are no limits to their so-called strategic cooperation partnership. China is Russia's most important partner, but within certain limits. On one hand, China is a major purchaser of Russian oil and is one of Russia's key trade partners overall. Russia and China continue to conduct joint military exercises to demonstrate their solidarity. Xi Jinping and other top Chinese officials have unfailingly supported Russia's argument that NATO is responsible for the war. Chinese leaders may believe that a Russian defeat would leave China alone against Western pressure, whereas a Russian victory of some sort would strengthen Beijing's diplomacy, especially among developing countries. Some observers also speculate that China's ambition to reunify with Taiwan would be fed by a Russian victory, though I dispute that. The limits to the partnership are significant, though we should not go so far as China's ambassador to the European Union, who recently stated that, quote, no limit is nothing but rhetoric. One limit is that China has never condoned Russian territorial seizures from Ukraine, and to the contrary, has more than once indirectly criticized Russia by condemning attacks on independent countries. Second, major Chinese firms have been reluctant to challenge U.S. sanctions on Russia for fear of being sanctioned themselves. Third, China claims it has never supplied Russia with military hardware, though various reports indicate that China has sent Russia so-called non-lethal military assistance, such as spare parts and equipment. Let's examine that last point further. Chinese military aid to Russia is a matter of U.S. concern. In February, Secretary of State Antony Blinken indicated that he had evidence that Beijing was, quote, considering providing lethal support to Russia in its aggression against Ukraine, unquote. Blinken said he warned Wang Yi, China's top foreign policy official, that there would be serious consequences were that to occur. It now appears that Blinken's warning was based on U.S. intelligence intercepts of Russian communications in which the expectation was raised about receiving Chinese weapons in covert shipments. Other U.S. officials, unnamed, have disputed that report. Quote, we have not seen evidence, said one, that China has transferred weapons or provided lethal assistance to Russia, but we remain concerned and are continuing to monitor closely. President Biden himself has said he was unconvinced. The Chinese response to these warnings has been unequivocal. It's the U.S. and not China that has been incessantly supplying weapons to the battlefield, said a foreign ministry spokesman, and the U.S. is not qualified to issue any orders to China. And military aid to Russia has never been mentioned in any of the final statements following meetings between Russian and Chinese leaders. Indeed, no limits was not repeated when Putin and Xi had their most recent meeting in March. Their final statement was chock full of laudatory statements about Sino-Russian peace, friendship, and mutual support, but no mention was made about military shipments or about any kind of security alliance. The evident U.S. strategy is to use warnings to China as a means of deterring weapons shipments, but China's restraint may be due less to U.S. warnings than to self-interest. Why become party to a war in which China has no direct security interests and which would risk coming under U.S. trade sanctions and other pressures from U.S. allies? In a word, relations with the U.S. and allies such as Japan, Australia, and NATO are already very bad with China. There's no compelling reason to worsen them. China's stance on military aid to Russia is subject to change, however. It might happen if, as U.S. intelligence reportedly believes, Ukraine or NATO carries out attacks inside Russia. But I think the more likely occasion relates to U.S. policy on Taiwan. The closer the U.S. comes to diluting the long-standing policy of strategic ambiguity on defending Taiwan, and instead supports Taiwan's status as an independent country, the more likely does war with China become. Right-wing Congress members who are pushing not only for more military aid to Taiwan, but also for ditching strategic ambiguity, don't speak for official U.S. policy, but their rhetoric is surely being followed closely in Beijing. When a senior congressman such as Michael McCaul of Texas says, while leading a congressional trip to Taiwan, that if Ukraine doesn't win and Russia is successful, they see the bullseye turning to them, meaning China's neighbors, and the U.S. stands with you and will protect you. When he says that, he's asking for trouble. Bottom line, if U.S.-China policy continues down the path of strengthening political and military ties with Taiwan, China will very likely start sending weapons to Russia. And if a Chinese attack on Taiwan should ever occur, it most likely will be the result of U.S. policies that provoke it by crossing China's red line on Taiwan independence. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 25th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Michelle Coppola, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Nadia Ramlagan, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News on this beautiful spring day. My name is Sam, and this is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show about police oversight in Portland, and this month we're speaking with the current co-chairs of the Police Accountability Commission. The commission is tasked with creating a new police oversight system in Portland, and my co-host Jasmine and I spoke with them last Thursday, April 20th, and the full version of this interview can be found on the Totality of Circumstances show page at kboo.fm, along with our previous coverage of the commission and interviews with other commissioners.
So thank you both again for being with us today. We're speaking with Casey Lewis and Catherine McDowell, who are commissioners and current co-chairs of the structure and details phase of the Police Accountability Commission. And we're also joined by Austin Foster, the Community Engagement and Communications Coordinator. Thank you again, all of you, for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. And so the Police Accountability Commission, which we'll also refer to as the PAC or the PAC, is wrapping up its fourth phase of work, the structure and details phase. And unfortunately, the third co-chair of this phase, Charlie Michelle Wesley, wasn't able to be here today due to a scheduling conflict.
One of the things that we've heard in the community listening sessions that you've been doing is that the community is still kind of lacking a real clear idea of what the Police Accountability Commission is building and what this system will look like sort of when it's done.